I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and it is National Poetry Month. April, hello. Today we are joined by Hala Alyan. Hala is a Palestinian-American writer and poet with a doctorate in clinical psychology. She's got a brand new poetry collection that just released in March. It's called The Moon That Turns You Back. The poems explore the fragmenting effects of war and displacement on individual and collective identity and memory. And she and I talk today about what's going on in Palestine and what it's like to promote a book when there's a genocide happening. We also talk about being a psychologist whose patients read your work and, of course, the many, many books that Hala loves. Hala will be back on Wednesday, April 24th to discuss The January Children by Safia El-Hilo, which is our April book club pick. Quick reminder, everything we talk about in each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you like what you hear today, please consider joining The Stacks Pack, which is our community for book lovers over on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thestacks to join. When you join The Stacks, you earn perks like our bonus episodes, our Discord chat, and our virtual book club meetups. Plus, you get to know that your $5 a month makes it possible for me to make The Stacks every single week. Head to patreon.com/thestacks to join. And here's a shout out to some of our newest members. Alicia Clark, Sweet Tooth, Philip Sumby, Raymond Williams, Anya, Sarah Unra, Louis Rogers, and Angelina Labella. Thank you all so much for joining, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Hala Alyan. All right, everybody, I'm so excited. It is April, which means it's Poetry Month. I get to talk to a poet and novelist that I'm super excited about. It's Hala Alyan. She is the author of The Moon That Turns You Back, among other books, which we will talk about, but that's her latest. It's a poetry collection. It is in my absolute favorite color of pink. It's like the perfect pink. I just love it. Hala, welcome to The Stacks.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited. So that's sort of like a little bullshit professional intro, but why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am a Palestinian American author and clinical psychologist. I'm based in Brooklyn. I teach grad psych at NYU, and then I also write poetry and fiction. And more recently, I've been kind of dabbling in nonfiction and more like articles and stuff.
Yeah. I went to NYU, but though not for psychology.
Really?
I was an undergrad at NYU for theater. I'm a Tishy.
Oh, you're a Tish. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. I know. Ooh. Everyone hates us the most. The most hateable school at NYU, but also it's the best.
Yeah. It invokes a lot of feelings. That is true.
But let's be honest. Stern is the most hateable school at NYU.
I think that's probably, I mean, I probably shouldn't be on record saying any of this as an employee.
I'll say it.
Yeah, exactly. You say it for me. I will say I worked at the counseling center for a long time before I took the faculty position, and Tisch was always like, it was like the kids that come in from Tisch. You're like,
I'm sure the kids came into Tisch. Just like dumping. It was like for research for Strasburg or like doing the method.
It was method. I was just going to say it was just method. Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with the collection. And then I have other questions outside of that. But let's start with the collection. I think the thing that is most interesting to me to think about with the collection, because I think for folks who don't know you, I should give them a little background. Like you said, you're Palestinian American. You've been writing a lot about what's going on in Gaza, about the genocide, and about the violence. And you know, you've been talking a lot publicly about that, but this book came out this month or last month, I guess, when we're recording.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I have to assume you finished it long before or during the events of October 7th. So how has sort of the book coming out after like this sort of extremely public and in the media moment for Palestine, which of course is not new, but is very like prescient when this was done. And these were things you were thinking about prior to. So sort of like, how's that worked out for you?
So it's interesting because I would say that actually a lot of there is a, you know, I think of these as like, they're poems that have been written over the course of several years. And so there was like what happened in Gaza in 2021. And so there are poems kind of from that era. So there's already sort of, I mean, tragically, like there are already poems about Palestine and poems that touch upon some of these themes. And one of the things that I've done is there are pieces in here that have been published in the last few months in slightly edited forms. So there's like a poem called Naturalize that I think like the ending was slightly tweaked. There's a poem called Revision that my friend Hamid Sinno did like, and Josh Begley did like a video and like music, like sound art and whatever too, that was based off of the shorter poem called Political Dialogue that's in the piece. And becomes a revision of that and kind of is more placing that piece in this moment. So that has been interesting. I don't think I've ever done that before where like I've just like kind of taken poems that are already kind of on their way to the press and just like messed with them.
Right.
Because they like both apply to the moment and also kind of need a little bit of tweaking. Yeah. But I think having a book out right now in general, truthfully, for so many of us that are like so like, you know, I think diasporically and also allies, like just so like fixated on what's happening and like really kind of plugged in and trying to do the work of bearing witness and showing up and advocacy and awareness raising and whatnot. Like, I think, you know, I am one of several people in my friend group that's had a book come out in this recent period. And it's a very weird experience, right? Like, it feels like it's not a very celebratory time in general. And so it feels kind of strange to have to be in that space.
And how do you like go around doing book promotion and stuff? Like, how are you personally, I guess, like reconciling, you know, creating art and putting it into the world, which I think is generally a good thing, I like to think, but also like in a time, like you're saying, where it's kind of hard to be like, yay, buy my book.
I mean, I think I'm probably not from, I mean, not probably, I think I'm struggling with how much promotion and like how much marketing and how to use sort of platform and how to use social media. Like, I think it's in a different time, I would probably be posting about it more and posting like reviews and things that come out that I am very like, you know, grateful for. But it does feel like a sort of all eyes on us this moment. And so like, I'm trying to be mindful of like balancing those two things.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. I mean, we're not going to do our whole time on that, but I think it will come up plenty, especially when we talk at the end of the month about The January Children by Safia Ello, because that is another book about a region that has been consistently abused and, you know, in different time periods and this sort of, and she sort of is reckoning with, I think, similar things that you're reckoning with in your book.
Totally.
But I want to ask you, you know, I talk a lot about how I'm like not very good at poetry. I know that like poets hate when people say that, but I feel very insecure as a poetry reader. But I have, through this show, I have started reading more poetry and talking with more poets about poems. And I'm starting to like feel a little more confident after like four years of doing it. I'm like feeling a little better. And one of the things that I really really stuck with me from your collection is your use of different forms and styles in the poems, like the way that they appear on the page. Obviously, you have those like fiction, those like kind of like choose your own adventure poems. Interactive fictions. Then you have like the, I think it's, is it Guzzles. You have a bunch of those. And then you have like some poems where you have like a bunch of slashes and you have, you know, so I'm just wondering for you as you're creating, how are you thinking about the actual form that the poem takes on the page?
So I will say this is probably, not probably, this is definitely the most experimental book I've written. And it's the one where I've played with form the most. I am historically not somebody that like I'm not someone that agonizes over a like a line break, you know what I mean? Or like, like I'm sort of a bad poet in that way that like with most of what I've written, I just kind of write it. I just write it. And sometimes what I'll do is I'll just write a block of text and then go move it into couplets, which is, I think a lot of poets are much more like methodical and like mindful about how they use the real estate of the page. And for me, it's been, this is the first one where I've just been like, let's like break it. Let's like break some forms, put them back together. Let's like try to do some stuff that's like feels inventive. Obviously like the interactive fiction poems you talked about, it's borrowing from like the choose your own adventure. Like that's already a form that exists in a different genre.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I haven't really seen this in poetry and it would be sort of cool. I mean, they're so labor intensive because you have to write basically like 10 different poems in one poem. But like, it was so, once I got into the swing of it, I was like, this is actually kind of amazing. And like, really, like, it's like putting together a puzzle and like constantly thinking about how different language can, like how different words can play with other words and how different stanzas can be put together. And, can you write something that's versatile and flexible enough to be like configured in whatever way it needs to be? So yeah, I do feel like that is probably the thing I feel most proud of in the collection is that like, it is the one where like, I just walked into form, you know what I mean? Kind of unflinchingly. And even the ghazals, like I've never written a sonnet before in my life, for instance, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I'd never written a ghazal before this one, like before I wrote this like series of them. There's one poem that's kind of like a fill in the blank poem, like a key, like there's a key of words and you kind of, you know, so it's like, I think there's that, I found those, I think historically I've told myself a story about how I really don't like form and I don't really, you know, like I don't like to kind of, and like play with forms that are more complicated or take more time. I just want to sit. I want to let it flow. I want to whatever. And it turns out I really enjoyed it.
What made you decide to do it? Like, what was it that you were like, oh, I really want to try this
I'm time? I'm trying to remember. I think that, so a lot of the more experimental pieces, not the interactive fiction ones, but like the ghazals and the fill in the blank pieces and whatever, they were actually added on in this, like the publishers were like, I mean, I was driving them crazy because they were just like, this book is going to presses. And I was like, I have 20 more poems, please put this, you know. And also there's like I got my medical records from there was a period of time where I had a lot of infertility and a lot of miscarriages. And so I got those medical records and did these kind of erasure poems out of them. And so like, that was all really last summer. Like a lot of the pieces that are more experimental were through the summer, were this past summer. And I think what it did was I have a faculty position. So the summers are off. And so I had this time to, I like ended up taking a bunch of drop-in classes at like Brooklyn Poets. And I took, I think Poetry Society, there was like I can't remember who it was, but I took like a couple of workshops and I have not been a student in writing in a while. And it was so delicious. And like, I really recommend that for people. Like, it's like, just take a workshop. You know what I mean? Some of them are just like you drop in and you take the one, or some are like a couple of weeks or a few weeks or whatever. But I think that was like, the summer was really there. I had this space sort of time and like mental space and whatever to just kind of like really be a student and like play with different forms. And I think one of the prompts in one of the classes that I took was to do a ghazal. And I'd never done one before and I was really dreading it. And then I started to do it and was like, wait a second, I want to do 10 more of these.
I love it's them. Those are so my favorite.
Fun. They're so fun.
They're so fun. Can you explain to people who don't know what they are formally, like how they work?
I mean, I need to look up exactly because it's like I wrote them all. But basically you end like you find a word and that becomes the word that ends every sentence of the, or every couplet, right?
Yeah,
every couplet. Yeah, every couplet. Except for the first one. Because the first one is like both of them. You know, there's one that's like light ghazal. And so it'll like the structure is like the last two words of the first couplet are like light, light. And then it's different words.
Do you have your book
light.
In front of you?
I do, actually.
Will you read that or some of that one? It's on page 44.
Okay. So light ghazal. I'm terrible at parties, secrets, and money. I want my stars sexy. Fast light that's prophetic. No nonsense about physics, refraction, past light. Even in Barcelona, I can't turn a bike. I let you change my mind. Free will and wet hair. One night, I let you pour white wine and drink it's a gas light. Happy now? We're both like this, full of risk and nowhere to put it. We sidle up to strangers with dry cigarettes and ask, light? I want small churches and noisy continents. I want you. I want you better. I want you moved by what moves me. God, glass, light. You like the line about men bored with beautiful women, as though boredom's the prize, as though those peonies weren't a gaslight. It's okay. I play dumb. I count bank codes under my breath. I circle you like a devoted planet. I see the whiskey bottle. I forecast light. I'm a better gambler than wife. The house fills with music and your singing. Dear enabler, dear truce, I know you see the moon's steadfast light. I know you remember Madrid, Istanbul, pine cones, that trip to Iceland, how every midnight had a sun, how we clung to its last light.
So good. Okay, let's talk about language a little bit.
Let's do it.
You write poems and you write novels and they have different word counts for sure. I'm wondering how that is for you. Like, is the challenge of more words more difficult? Is the challenge of less words more difficult? What is interesting to you about writing a novel versus writing a book of poems? Like, how do those things, I guess, serve you as an artist? Like, what do you use them for? Any and all of those kind of questions?
You know, I think there is something in the writing of a poem. How do I put this? I trust my poems more than I trust any other form or any other genre of mine. And by that, I mean, I could go months and do often go months without writing a single poem. And I don't think twice about it. Like, it's the one genre that I'm just like, I really am like, it'll come when it comes. Like, there, I'll be inspired when I'm inspired, and then I'll sit down and I'll write like seven of them, you know, and then I won't write for a while and then I'll come back and do, you know. So it's the one, it's actually the relationship I have with my poetry probably is the healthiest from the perspective of just like very much hands off the steering wheel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like time to write a poem, I'll know it's time to write a poem. Fiction and long form nonfiction are different in that, like, I'm working on a memoir now, and I think this has been the hardest project I've ever worked on, the memoir. Mm. And I think part of that is I have a really hard time writing in first person. Part of it is like, I've sort of hid behind poetry and you know, kind of autobiographical fiction for so long that, like, in this case, the I means the I, like, there's nothing between you and the, it's just, it is what it says it is. And so that kind of like stresses me out. But I think in general, longer form projects, it's like, it just takes me so much more time. Like, it's, I mean, obviously. And also what I mean by that is like, because it takes so much more time, my practice has to be a more dedicated one and a more disciplined one. So I really find myself needing to, like, I have to do 30 minutes a day or some, you know, like, I have to try to write a little bit every day. It's not dissimilar to like trying a radical workout, you know, where it's just like, you kind of have to keep running or you got to keep lifting or you got to keep whatever. I don't do any of those things, but from what I hear,
from what I've been told.
Exactly. Right on the street is like, if you're going to do like deadlifts, like, you can't just do that and then like wait to be inspired to do that again. Right. Like, the project, the process of that is going to be different, and the relationship of discipline is going to be different. So also because you'll lose the thread. So there's a novel that I worked on for a very long time, or not a very long time, maybe a year. And then stopped working on it for a very long time. This is during like infertility days, pandemic, et cetera. Went back to it and it's like kind of unrecognizable now. Like, now I'm just like, shit, I think I maybe, like, these characters might be done with me. Like, I don't know that there's a way to revive it. I think there's elements of the story that now I know how to put into a different kind of thing. But it's like, you can't just wait to want to come back to something when it's longer form.
That's so interesting. I've never really thought about I mean, I'm not a writer, I'm a reader. Mm. So I think a lot about like the finished thing, but I'd never, and I talk a lot to a lot of writers about their process, but I've never heard anyone sort of describe it as like intense physical exercise where you really need, like I've heard people say like you need to do discipline or write every day, but they've never really sort of explained it in that way of like, you can't just like become like a heavy weight lifting person if you just like lift today and then like in 6 weeks you're like, let me try 500 pounds.
You truly cannot. Like, you know, there's no way to do it. Like, it just doesn't work. And I think, I mean, I like also like the coherence of a longer, because poems, I mean, what's interesting about poems is it's like listening to people talk about their dreams or like administering a Rorschach test or something. Like, things can seem really disjointed, but then when you're putting together a collection, you're like, oh, this is a snapshot of these years of a person's life. And of course some coherence is going to emerge. And of course some theme is going to emerge, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But like, you can kind of trust that it will cohere and it will take a shape that it needs to,
right.
As opposed to, I think there's something in the, like with fiction, you can't like, you have to be actively showing up. You have to be actively, because you have to keep picking up the threads you put down day after day after day, or else, I mean, the story's not going to write itself. You know?
Right. That's so interesting. I literally last night just started Hanif Abdurraqib's newest book, and you know, it's long form nonfiction, and I got like 4 pages in and I just was like, I know that he knows where this is going. Like, I know he knows what he's doing, but how does he know? Like, how does he know what he's doing? Because, like, in the first 5 pages, it's like James Brown, Michael Jordan, the Fab Five. Like, I'm just That's like, really what? Funny. I'm like, where are we going? So anyways, it's funny that you said that, because I had that thought of like, how do authors know where they're going?
I often don't, for what it's worth. Like I do a lot of story. I often don't. I do a lot of storyboarding. Like I sort of steal that from like script writing. So like, I'll do like a big, like, you know, poster board, and then use different colored note cards and kind of like put together, like, you know, the green means this character, blue means this era, blah, 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 blah. Especially because I often work with like multi-generational stuff and often in different timelines. Right. So there is some structure, you know, so you have some semblance of like, I know where this character is going to be in like 1972, but then you start writing and then it's like, you can't control your character. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of like fiction, really, is like characters just become their own. I really miss writing. No, I've like, I really want to go back to fiction. Like, characters just fucking do what they're going to do. You know, they just like, they show up, they start sleeping with each other. They start like leaving their job. They start making bad choices, you know? And so there is some element, this is like the magic of any sort of creative work for me, at least, is that it's just like, I do visual stuff sometimes too, where it's like, you start putting colors, you start doing whatever, and you're just like, you really don't know. And every brushstroke, or everything you know, if you collage, every, like, you put a thing in one corner, or you write a character, okay, you know what, the character impulsively decides to buy a ticket to California, like, what is that then going to do to the whole story? We have no idea. And like, there's something in that, I am just as eager of an observer of what's going to happen next as like any final reader is. And it's like such a delightful process.
I have heard so many writers say a similar thing of like, you don't know what your characters are going to do. As a reader, and as a like very type A person, I do not believe you guys. Anytime someone says that to me, I'm just like, so why did you start writing this book if you have no clue what these people are going to do? I know that it must be true for all of you who say that to me, but in my brain, because I only see the finished product, I'm like, of course you knew Michelle was going to sleep with John. Like, hello, she entered the scene.
It
was very obvious. You were broadcasting it from page 5. Like, it's really hard for me to like wrap my head. Yeah, to wrap my head around it. Even though I know, like, when I've done visual art, I used to do these like collages with my mother-in-law.
Right.
You'd start with these pieces of paper, and then you'd put like some texture down, like some like Mod Podge, and then you wait for it to dry, and then you'd paint it, and then you'd like, and so I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know what it would turn out as. But when I think about that for a book, I'm like, what do you mean you didn't know?
So I will say this, the perfect example of that on the other end, from a different vantage point, is that I once did a reading at a university, and one of the professors that like came up to me was like, I teach your book in my class. It was a poetry collection. I was like, great, amazing. Thank you so much. And he was like, it was, I think, the 29th year. And he was like, and we talk a lot about how the birds that are in the book, you know, they symbolize migration, they symbolize flight, they symbolize whatever. And Tracy, I just looked at him I've never written the word bird down. I don't know anything about a bird. I don't know what you're talking about. And that, and he looked at me, I mean, kind of gave me like, okay, I'm going to move away from this conversation.
All right,
he's
just,
he was like, yeah, he's like, okay. Yeah. But he was like, well, there's a lot of bird. I was like, no, there's not a single bird in this book. I went home that night or back to the hotel and just flipped through the copy. And my God, if not every other page, like, or every, wow, like every other poem, every three poems, there was some form of bird and some form of flight and some form of motion and some form of whatever. So I think like that's sort of the proof from a different vantage point is like, also, right, you don't know what you're putting on the page in some, right, way. And that is maybe the thing I am most excited about when I think about writing and as a reader is what the writer didn't know they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot here, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, you know, for book club about like close reading. Cause I sort of joke that I'm not a close reader. Like, I'm not usually, yeah, a person who notices like all those little things, though. Sure. There was one word that appears a ton in Safia's book that I do want to talk about. Mm-hmm. But there are people who are part of like this community who are super close readers, and they'll, right, be like, oh, did you notice this little thing? And I'm always like, wow, I super duper wonder if the author knew. Because sometimes I'm like, okay, right, the author knew. But sometimes I'm like, that was a perfect mistake and they, uh-huh, have no clue. But they're going to start, that's telling, right, people. They were like, oh, I read about, that's, birds.
Right. That's right. That's right. So, I mean, totally. I think there is something about the, like, I don't know how much authors No. And I also am not, I think some authors are probably more like, there's more of a premeditation. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think like, I don't have the patience, but like, I'll just sort of be like, I'm going to write and it's going to be whatever it's going to be. And we're going to take it from there. But I've definitely heard writers talk about like, you know, spending months storyboarding as a book before, yeah, before they even begin it.
Yeah. I think it's like a personality type too. Like certain people, right, like the way you create your art is just different, you know, like, cause I've heard a whole spectrum of things, but anytime someone's, that's like, right, I didn't know what the characters were going to do, I'm like, I don't believe you. How is that?
I totally got it. Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you, because your other job is you're a clinical psychologist.
Yes.
And a professor. Do your patients know that you are a writer? Do they know about like your life?
I think at this point, most people, I mean, think of it like if you were going to look up a therapist or like, you know, you'd probably Google, right, them. So, right, I think like it was like when I was starting out, you know, it was like even just 10 years ago, it wasn't that like I think it wasn't that common. Like people still kind of Googled each other, but it wasn't so like par for the course. Whereas now, like, I think the first thing you do,
right,
look up your therapist or you look up your doctor, or you look up your whatever. So I think it doesn't take much to like discover that somebody has, like, especially if they have any sort of public facing, you know, work.
Right.
So yes, I would say virtually everybody I work with knows that I do this.
Has anyone ever been like, oh, I read your poems or I read your novel?
Oh yeah. And
what's that like?
I've had patients come to book launches, which like technically not supposed to do, but like, I mean, you know, you also can't like tell someone to leave before, like, you know. I actually think it's one of those things where if you're going to do something again, that's like Googleable or like discoverable on a public platform, like, yeah, you kind of have to, my approach with the therapy part of it is like, you have to be willing to answer to it. Like you have to be able to have, yeah, that conversation as a therapist. So like, I'm very much like an open book where it's like, yes, what was it like to read this thing? What was it like to read like your therapist talk about this or that? What was it, you know?
Right.
Cause I think like, I also write about all sorts of, you know, like I'll write about marriage and sex and life and loss and grief and, you know, miscarriages. And it, you know, like,
right,
like it's like, there's nothing that's kind of off the table. And so sometimes talking about things that have been published has led to like really actually beautiful and poignant conversations with clients.
Yeah. I was sort of thinking it could kind of go like a lot of ways, but, mm-hmm, you know, like if you know information about your therapist's life, it's like, well, I saw your medical records in the poem, you know, the medical record poem. So
exactly. Like, yeah, exactly. I think it's more like what I'm doing is more than the average bear in terms of therapy. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
like my clients know more about me than your average like clinician,
right,
you know?
Right.
And that's just part of it. And I think it, like, that's not for everyone. And I definitely think there are some people who do not want to know this much about their therapist. Like, it's distracting, yeah, it's whatever. So it's never like, I think I'm pretty open. Like when people talk about like, oh, I read a thing or I watched a thing, and we'll have like very open conversations about what it was like, you know?
Yeah.
And it's only happened a couple of times, because I think it's sort of like a self-selected group. Like if somebody, you know, if you were to Google a therapist and see that therapist is also an actor, right? Or is also, yeah, a musician or whatever, like if that's not what you're looking for, or something about that makes you uncomfortable, you're probably not going to pursue.
Right. Right.
You know, so it's like the people that come in, by the time they come in the door, they've probably already done a little bit of like
research recon. And they feel like it's a good fit. Yeah. It's just so interesting. Yeah. Thinking about like, cause as I was reading this, I was like, she's got students, she's got patients.
Yeah. Like, it's all just out there. I mean, it's all out there. It's like very, it's actually kind of lovely in a weird way. Cause there's no, I think I spent my youth being very, I'm only thinking about this now actually. That I think I spent my youth, like my childhood and my like adolescence, I was like very, a sort of a pathological liar, to be honest. And like was always sort of very secretive and would like tell half truths and whatever. Mm-hmm. There's something kind of beautiful about kind of having arrived at an adulthood where it's just sort of like everything's in the open. Everything is like fodder. Everything can be discussed. Everything can be written about. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about your piece in the New York Times. I think it was an audio essay about like auditioning for empathy. Mm. I read it. I didn't listen to it, but so I can't remember. Was it? I think it was an audio.
It was
piece,
both.
Right?
It was both.
Okay.
It was, like,
I read the transcript.
They turned it into, turned it into an audio thing as well.
Would you just talk about this idea of like auditioning for empathy? I found it to be really interesting and I'm just curious to hear you kind of talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think like, you know, the groups of people that have to audition for empathy are often the groups of people that have like experienced profound levels of dehumanization. And so in this moment on this topic, it was related to obviously Palestinians, but I think that's something we've seen like in our country. We see it around like Black communities, we see it around different brown communities, queer communities. Like I think there is a way in which marginalization, like groups that are marginalized and have historically been oppressed, you know, I mean, again, it's hard to oppress people if you haven't dehumanized them. Like right. The dehumanization is sort of crucial in the process of enacting injustice, which is why the reverse of that is crucial in the process of enacting justice, right? Being able to identify it, point at it, start to undo it, start to challenge it. And so the piece was about, you know, my vantage point as a Palestinian American that sort of had this interesting thing where I wasn't just raised here. You know, right. Like I know a lot of people that were like here during 9/11 as Arabs or as Muslims or, you know, had sort of these experiences. I was in Beirut during that time. I was in Lebanon and I spent the first 4 years of my life in Kuwait and then like the Midwest and then middle and high school and college was in different parts of the Arab world and then came back for grad school. So like right. I've had the experience of inhabiting an identity that like was like a non-negotiable one in a lot of places and then coming as an adult essentially here where it was suddenly like challenged and questioned and like demoted, you know what I mean? So like, I think that like, it's kind of writing about what it's like to watch Palestinians kind of have to constantly sort of sing for their supper, so to speak, right. Or sing for empathy or try to get like, yeah, just kind of like, yeah.
In that piece, you talk about how people like at your book events or, you know, would be like, oh, you really humanized like the Palestinian, whatever. And you talk about like, well, you know, your response is sort of, maybe not to them, but in your head at least is like, well, what were they if not
before,
human? Like,
yeah,
what were they before I did that? And I'm wondering like, that was your first novel that you were referring to when you wrote Salt Houses.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, since then you've written another novel, you've written this poetry collection. Do you feel differently about like your job as an artist as far as like humanizing? Do you feel like you want to buck up against that? Like, are you trying to subvert this idea that like your job as a Palestinian American writer is to humanize Palestinian people? Or do you embrace that sort of obligation?
I mean, it's really interesting because I think I have been lucky thus far in that the stories I have felt drawn to tell happen to also overlap with this thing that I do feel strongly about, which is like representation and write and people who know and experience being the ones that write it, you know? Mm-hmm. So the novel that once I finished this memoir that's literally sapping me of life, like then the project that I want to go to is this is I just like had this idea years ago and it's like kind of stuck with me as a woman who is basically like, you know, goes back to try to figure out in her adulthood what happened to her college roommate who was murdered, who was found murdered during their senior year, you know? So like it's kind of like thrillery, it sort of has a mystery element to it. I've never written anything like that before. I've never even thought about writing anything like that before. Like I think that will be, and it has an element of like you know, it talks about Arabness, it talks about whiteness, it talks about what it is to sort of like try on different identities and co-opt identities and whatever. But it's certainly taking me in a different, like will take me in a different direction. And I don't know what it'll feel like to do that. I don't know if it'll feel like I'm sort of, you know, like I should keep writing the multi-generational stories. Like I think the multi-generational like Arab family story is sort of my, like that's my jam. Like I kind of love reading them. I love writing them. I love thinking about them, but there is something, you know, like there is something kind of liberating about being able to say like, regardless of your identity, you can go tell a different kind of story. That's okay. And can trust that the stories around the identity and around the history will still be there to tell. And also that other people will be telling them too. Like that's the thing about representation is if there's good enough representation, then no one person feels like they have to be an ambassador of an experience.
Right, right. That's so right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, we're back. I didn't prep you for this, and I know that you have a little bit of a fever, so don't yell at me, but you're going to have to use your brain a little bit. Okay.
I love it.
Don't fight me. This is called Ask the Stacks. People write in and they ask for book recommendations. Okay. They email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com. Send your in people because we're running low. This one comes from Melissa and she says, I love books that show a great appreciation for cities. Books set in places like New York City, Chicago, and most especially Los Angeles, where the city plays a major role Those books are always fun for me. They can be nonfiction like The Devil in the White City or fiction like a recent read, American Mermaid. Just give me some description of the architecture or action on the city streets or a moment in the city's history, including present day, and I'm a happy reader. Do you have any books that stood out to you where the city setting really came alive? So the first thing that came to my head was nonfiction, which is a book called People Who Eat Darkness by Richard Lloyd Perry. It's a true crime book, and it's about a murder of like a white girl in Japan. And it's in this one neighborhood in Japan that I actually read the book while on my trip to Japan, and it turned out our hotel was in that neighborhood. So like this book is like very seared into my brain. Like we went past the police station they talk about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really great. So that's my first one. You only have to do one, Hala. I'm going to do three. My second one is a book.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that the one that's coming up is Sabrina and Karina. I don't know if you've read it by Kelly Cardo Enston. They're short stories, and they're mostly, the protagonists are mostly like women and femmes, and they take there. It's like a lot of Latinas, often of indigenous descent, within the the West and the Southwest. And so it's really like the that landscape, that part of the country, that like the relationship between the land and like the stories that unfold is incredibly salient in that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Okay. I have two more. Just all of mine are nonfiction. Sorry. I am who I am. One is a book that comes out later in April. It's called Everest Inc. And it's about Mount Everest. I know that's not a city, but you really get a sense of the mountain and the people climbing it. And it just feels so like site specific. There are some issues with the book as far as how the Sherpa people are talked about. Not great, but it's a very interesting, well-researched book that as a kind of discerning reader, I was able to be like, okay, the author's getting in my way here, but it's you know, like sometimes you can do that a little bit. It just feels like a little dated Sherpa representation.
Don't
love. And then my third book, which I haven't finished yet, I just said I was in the throes of reading, is the new Hanif book. It's all about Columbus, Ohio, and Ohio. And it's called There's Always This Year.
I'm so excited to read that book.
I'm 20 pages in, and I'm like so excited. I'm a big basketball fan. The book is like his book about basketball, but also it's about home, and he's from Columbus, and he writes so well about everything that I have to imagine he's going to write beautifully about the place that he loves so much.
Question. Yes. If you know nothing about basketball and are completely unmoved by it, will you still like this book?
So I have heard from people who have finished it who do not care about sports or basketball at all, and they love, love, love it. Like, okay, they're like, writing. I mean, I think all his books are sort of like that. Like,
He's also just brilliant.
He's just brilliant. I mean, yeah, like when you're that level good, it's sort of like, oh, I'm writing about like this specific thing that no one's ever heard of. But if you're good, you'll make us, you know, hear and care. So those are our recommendations, folks. And Melissa, if you read any of those, let us know what you think. And everyone else, email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com. So send us your recommendations. We have questions. We have things to recommend. All right. Now it's time for you to talk about the books of your life. Two books you love, one book you hate.
I love The Vanishing. So I'm just going to go in the last year, okay? Because otherwise I'm going to get overwhelmed. In the last year, I loved Bliss and Sorrow.
Okay.
And I loved The Vanishing Half.
Mm.
And a book that I hated. I mean, I don't know that I don't.
You could go further back than the last year if you want to do a book you hate, so you don't have to worry
about. I've never been able to get through a single Ernest Hemingway book.
Oh, me neither.
Which has always made me feel like a bad reader. Because I'm like very unmoved by that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
What kind of reader are you?
I love reading. I am very voracious sometimes. And that it's usually like actually a good marker of how well I'm doing in my life is whether I'm reading actively or not. So if I haven't read in a while, it's like things aren't going great. I'm a very fast reader. I can kind of speed read. And so actually when I'm really loving a book, I have to flow. Like I really am like very, will kind of very mindfully slow down the pace that I'm getting through it so that I don't finish it too quickly. But I'm not a big read several things at the same time. I find that kind of distracting. I will say I very new development in my life is that I started listening to audiobooks specifically of memoirs. It's the only thing that I listen to, but I actually can't imagine listening to a novel. But the memoir, then now you're talking, cause I love podcasts. Now you're talking like a 9-hour podcast where a person is talking about their life.
Yeah.
Delicious. I mean, it's like a therapist's dream. You know what I mean? And there, cause there are, I mean, I only listen to ones that are like narrated by the memoirists themselves. Yeah. And so it's like kind of like the most amazing experience.
Yeah. That was my gateway.
Yeah. I just listened to, What My Bones Know.
Oh, Stephanie Fu.
And like, she also was like American, like she also, her voice is amazing and like, kind of like knows how to do this thing, but it was so wonderful.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm going to spend, you know, like 10 hours with this person and just hear about their life and hear about their, like be let into their world. So yeah, I can't quite, I've tried to audiobook like poetry, like it hasn't really worked in any other genre, but I love the memoir.
Yeah. Memoir read by author was my gateway into audiobooks. The more that I listen to audiobooks, the more that I can listen to on audiobooks.
So like it's almost like a muscle. Like fiction now?
Not on audio. I don't love fiction generally. I'm very discerning about what fiction I pick up. I almost have to like know that I'm going to like it like because it's struggle. There are a few fiction books I've read on audio that I've liked.
So it's not. So fiction in general is, what is it about it that doesn't?
I don't know. I think sometimes like being able to predict what's going to happen gets in my way of reading a novel in a way that with nonfiction, I either don't need to because I already know what's going to happen or I have no clue what's going to happen. I think sometimes I like judge what's going to happen in fiction. Like I'm like, oh, this is not believable in a way that if I know it's true, I'm like, well, I have to believe it because it really happened. And I also think that I like a lot of plot. And so a lot of books that people recommend to me are books that are much more character driven and I struggle with those. So I try really hard to like do a little bit more research about fiction that I read because I really don't like not liking a book. Like I really don't like being like, ugh, this is a slog because I just have to read so much. So I've started actually doing a little more genre fiction because knowing that I know it's going to have a happy ending if it's a romance
right,
or knowing that it's going to get solved kind of takes that like part out for me. But I don't know. I really like true stories. I like documentaries. Like I just like,
I see. So that's like pretty consistent across mediums.
Yeah, I think so. I like reality TV. I do like some scripted, but still very formulaic. Like my favorite TV show is Grey's Anatomy. I know what's going to happen.
Oh, interesting.
I don't like where I'm like trying to figure it out, but I'm not sure. Like I'm just like, tell me what's going to happen.
That's really
or
funny.
Like don't
or just don't.
Yeah, because like I watched like Succession. Do you watch that show?
I've watched.
Or did you?
Yeah.
And the whole time I'm watching, I'm just like, okay, so this is the next move. So I think maybe that's part of why. But on audio fiction is hard.
I was just going to say, I've never tried it. I've never tried audio fiction.
It's hard because there's characters and I want to have more opinions about that.
Yeah.
I want to have more opinions about the characters in my brain. Whereas with nonfiction, it's a little bit easier, I think. What are you reading right now?
Actually, in this very moment, nothing. And that is something I gotta pick a book. I have this like, you know, like there's one of my bookshelves is like just books that I haven't read yet. Yeah. And so I actually yesterday was kind of like, should I go nonfiction? Should I go fiction? Mm. Should I go nonfiction? Should I go fiction? And then I just went to sleep. But I think like that's like I'm kind of in that delicious. I sort of love this moment where you're like about to start a project, you're about to start reading something. So it's interesting because you just said, what are you reading? And I don't know that I think of audio as reading. So I guess if we are including audio, then I would say I'm listening to Sloane Crosley's Grief is for People.
The Grief is for People one. Are you liking it?
I am, actually. I am. There's certain parts that I am like, I'm only about halfway through and there's certain, like she's weaving in a bunch of different things. It's like the primary story is about her friend's suicide. And it's very like, and like also how that happened a month after she got burglarized. And so it's like about like loss and grief in these different ways. And she's sort of starting to weave in other things. And I feel like sometimes I'm losing the plot a little bit, but she is such a, like, she's one of those writers that's so engaging and so funny. And so, you know what I mean? Like evocative that you kind of, I'm kind of like, I'll follow you where you, wherever you go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Interesting.
I also read I listened to Leslie Jameson's Splinters right before that.
And like, how was that as an audiobook? I haven't read it yet, but I want to do it on audio.
I would listen to it audio. I mean, she also has a beautiful voice. I don't know.
Beautiful speaking voice.
Very beautiful speaking voice, very like slow and melodic. And yeah, it's like a very, you know, painful story about like a divorce and like, you know, like again, also lost in these different ways. Like, I've enjoyed it.
Do you do celebrity memoirs on audio ever?
I don't think I've ever read a celebrity memoir in my life.
They're really? So fun. Yes. They're so fun.
Is that where
fun.
It's at?
I mean, that's what like, for me, a lot of times audiobooks end up being like something that I'm reading when I'm doing dishes or folding laundry and like kind of just like want a little break. And I like celebrity culture. I'm very into it. So like it's like Britney Spears' memoir is so much fun on audio. Mariah Carey's memoir is so much fun on audio. But like sometimes I'll pick up one that I'm not that interested in. Like Demi Moore was not excited about it, but someone told me it was good and it was like great.
Was it good?
I knew nothing about her.
Really?
And I was like really into it. Yeah. I just think they're fun. Viola Davis's is great. I've heard Sinead O'Connor's is fantastic. That's like the next one I'm going to do. But yeah, I sort of like them on audio. And they almost always read their own, obviously, because they're famous.
So that, yeah, I was thinking of listening to I'm Glad My Mom Died.
Oh yeah, that's great on audio. Trevor Noah's is great on audio. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Trevor Noah's is one of the, that was my first ever real audiobook and it is a perfect gateway audiobook.
Okay. So then I need to, All right. This feels
it's a good one. Yeah. There you go. There's some recs. Okay. How do you pick the next thing you're going to read? Like what will you do? Do you have like a list going? Do you take recommendations from your friends or family? Is it just you look at your shelf and feel the vibes?
I think I look at the shelf and feel the vibes. I'm just like, am I looking to be sad? Am I looking to be devastated? I like how those are the two options, sad or devastated.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like I'm looking, you know, where am I at right now? I have a lot of nonfiction, like a lot of like historical nonfiction that I really, really should get to because I feel like I'm kind of like learn more about this world, you know, there's so much I don't know, but it's always like, you know, I have a toddler, like I'm always so tired at the end of the day that I'm just like, just give me something I can sink into. But yes, I do. I like follow a lot of like, you know, Instagram accounts that like center like reading and write. So like, I will often like keep kind of a running list going. And every now and then we'll just order a bunch and keep, I mean, you know, it's, I'm not someone that orders like one and then reads it and then orders another and then reads it. You know what I mean? Like I definitely like have way too many books that I have not like begun to read and it makes me feel safe. Actually,
I can relate. I have so many books that I've never read and many that I never will read likely, but I need them
exactly.
all around me at all times,
right.
just in case.
That's right.
Like I don't read horror. I'm terrified of horror. I can't do it. But I have like 12 horror books just like in case I get like weird with myself. I don't know.
That's so funny.
Like, in case I change.
It's so funny you say that because I very recently read, God, now I'm not going to remember what it was. It was like The Guest or something. The Quiet Tenant. And it was by this like a Clémence Michelon. I think she's French. And I've not read a book like it's about like a serial killer. And I've not read a book like this maybe in my life. Certainly not since I was like a teenager. And it just, I don't know what it was. Something was calling for like some like just gore and it was excellent.
Oh, wow. I love that. Yeah. I love that. Okay. What's a book that you love to recommend to people?
I love to recommend, I mean, I'm a big, like for poetry, I love Mahmoud Darwish. I think that's like a very stereotypical thing for an African, like a Palestinian to say, but I really do. I think like his writing is really beautiful. It's so tragic to me that I can't read it. Like I speak Arabic, but I can't read or write it really. Like I'm like a second grader.
Do you have an ideal reading setup, like a time of day, a location, snacks or beverages, temperature, music? Kind of what's the perfect reading?
No music. I'm actually where I'm sitting right now is like this monstrously big day bed in my living room that really is not a great decor choice, but is just so comfortable. And I sleep in it because it's like right next to my daughter's bedroom. So I sleep in it all the time, just like because I pass out here. And it's very comfortable and there's a ton of pillows and like a lot of blankets nearby. The snack that I like since I was a kid, because I was like super voracious reader when I was a kid, is always like, I love eating lemons and salt. And when I say lemons, I mean, I eat them like an apple. Like I eat the rind. I know it's
what?
Very weird. Your face looks amazing. Just
like I'll just I've like never cut heard up, of this.
I'll cut up a lemon into like little like wedges, get some salt going, just dip it in the salt, and then you just eat it with the rind. And the rind kind of cuts the bitterness.
I was picturing you taking a bite like an apple out of a lemon.
That's also happened before.
What?
Yeah. I love a good lemon.
A regular lemon? A Meyer lemon or just a straight just up a lemon, bitter?
A lemon. Lemon. You know what's really funny?
This is the craziest thing I've ever heard. I love this.
This is going to be the second craziest thing you've ever heard is my kid, since she was like one, she calls them Yemens. She loves lemon. And when I say she loves lemon, she just likes to like suck on a unsalted, unsugared lemon.
And my kids like lemons too. They call them manus. 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 She's not anymore.
And so like people will be like, okay, get that from your mom. Cause like, I've like that. So that is a snack that I think because I did it so much when I was a kid is like when I'm reading and if like kind of have a hand for it, like that's the one that I find myself like salivating for. It's super weird. I recognize. And so all my books are like a lot of my books are really sticky.
And smell like lemons,
which is a great thing to smell like.
Which is a great smell. It's so funny. The reason I added this question to the questionnaire was exactly for an answer like yours. Like something unique and special and something that I'd never... A lot of times, you know, I get popcorn and wine, not salted lemon. Funny. Incredible. Do you have a favorite bookstore?
I really love Greenlight Books. I've done like a launch there before. I like Bookstore Magic. I like Word Bookstore. Those are three like local ones that are like within the vicinity of where I live in Brooklyn. I love like a small indie bookstore. It's like nothing feels cozier to me in the world.
The best. What's the last book that made you laugh?
Actually, the Sloane Crosley, there's been a couple of like laugh aloud moments in like her writing where like she also because she has this very like very soothing and also somehow simultaneously sardonic voice. And so there's a way that she delivers her lines that like I've like there have been a couple times where I've just like honked with laughter on like the train.
I love that. What about the last book that made you cry?
Last book that made me cry probably would have been Bliss and Sorrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The last book that made you angry?
I was rereading The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pape, who's like an Israeli historian, and just, you know, like in the last few months. And it was making me angry and sad and frustrated and whatever. And I'm just like, I wish people would just like read more about the history, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. What about the last book where you felt like you learned a lot?
I think actually that book probably, because I think I'd like read it kind of in a cursory fashion years and years ago, because I was like, oh, I should know this stuff, you know, like I should read this. And reading it now against the backdrop of everything that's happening was like the stakes are so different. And it like really was like, oh my God, this has been ongoing for like 3/4 of a century. like I was like really seeing it and also kind of seeing, there's a lot of like, I mean, this isn't so much in the book, but I've also been like looking at imagery from the late 40s and like how much it mimics the imagery that's coming out now. And it's just like really heart-wrenching. Yeah.
Yeah. History, when you start digging in, it's really upsetting. It's not good.
It's very upsetting.
Yeah. I think that's why so many people are like, I don't like history. I'm like, yeah, because you start to feel pretty horrible.
Because it doesn't feel good.
People behave badly. Is there a book that you wish more people like read or knew about?
There's a poetry collection by Renoué Jauhari that's called Bint, B-I-N-T. And it's like such a stunning book and should be like a book that like people read in classrooms and stuff. It's really beautiful. I would say I found, although I think this is relatively people like Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City by Jane Wong to be really beautiful.
I don't know the memoir.
Okay, great. Yeah. So that's what I would say, like, check out.
Okay. I guess since you have this whole other career and job, I should ask you this. Are there any books that influenced your other professional career, your psychology career?
That's a good question. Okay. So there's a book called by Philip Zimbardo called The Lucifer Effect. And I think the tagline is like understanding how good people turn evil. And it talks a lot about like, it kind of unpacks the Stanford prison experiment. And they basically just talk like, you know, he I mean, I don't know how I feel about the word evil, but like he basically talks about the psychology of people doing things that feel, you know, outside the norm of their like value systems, and how much it, like, and really how it doesn't take much for people to kind of like buy into like power dynamics and start like, you know, mistreating others.
That book sounds extremely my shit. That's like the kind of thing I like
think
to read
you'd like
about.
It. Yeah, I think it's
okay. I'm going to immediately go get that. If you were a high school teacher, what's a book you would assign your students?
I think in this moment, I would love to like assign more stuff by and about Palestine. I think that's like something that's really underrepresented. I think I would also, I feel like in high school, I didn't really read a lot of poetry. I think I would like go hard on poetry as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last one. If you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
Probably like the, like a book by Rashid Khalidi or a book by Alain Pape or a book like, I mean, something in this particular moment to like get right with your history. You know what I mean? Like if you're still going to make the choices you're making, make them, but like at least like have studied your history from all angles.
Joe. I got big energy for Joe these days. This has been a conversation with Hala Alyan. Her new book is The Moon That Turns You Back. She will be back with us April 24th. We're discussing the January children. I'm so excited. It's poetry month. We're digging in, you guys. I cannot wait. So get your copies of that book. Get your copies of Hala's books. She's got many. So if you've already read The Moon That Turns You Back, you could read. She's got two novels, two other poetry collections, or three other poetry collections?
I think this is the fifth. Four other.
Oh.
Yeah.
Damn.
So
you guys have reading to do. How about that?
There's
plenty of time. Hala, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Hala for joining the show. I'd also like to say a quick thank you to Nina Leopold for helping to make this conversation possible. Hala will be back with us on Wednesday, April 24th for the Stacks Book Club discussion of the poetry collection, The January Children by Safia El-Hilo. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. If you're interested in more of my hot takes, go to tracythomas.substack.com and subscribe to Unstacked. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirages. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.